let's just start by looking at looking back to history to maybe an eternity ago. Mm-hmm. I remember a time when computers didn't even need firewalls or anti-spyware or anti-spam filters or even antivirus. In fact, there was a time when I told people, if you know, unless you're dealing with bulletin boards on a regular basis, and that kind mm-hmm. of dates me, you don't even need an antivirus program. Well, yeah, computer security is changing faster than most people can keep up with it. You need all kinds of different things just to make yourself safe. How would you characterize the major changes that you've encountered over the past, oh, say, 5 years?
So I think the big shift in the last 5 years has been the move away from, I guess, notoriety-driven malicious activity online towards financially-driven online malicious activity. So if you think about it, you know, when computers first, you know, became very popular and people started using PCs, the big thing was, from a security perspective, was preventing things like viruses and so on and so forth from getting onto your machine. That's still a concern, I think, but the main shift in my mind has been towards people who are not just trying to get your machine infected, but trying to do so for some financial reason. So, for example, whether it's trying to steal your information or monitor what types of transactions you're doing online, or simply using your machine as a commodity to mount other attacks as a launch point, if you will. So in my mind, that's been the biggest shift in the last few years.
Now, we hear a lot about botnets, and there are estimates that just range by, I think, several orders of magnitude. Do you have any idea how many of machines have become part of botnets?
It's a tough number to estimate. I think the reason we see so many different numbers out there is there are different, I guess, discrepancies in terms of how you actually count, you know, what is considered a unique infected machine. My sense is it's definitely in the millions, if not more than that, just by looking at some of the numbers we get in at Symantec. Now, we only see, in some sense, subset of the malicious activity going on in the world. It's always hard to identify what's malicious versus what's not from our global perspective, but we are able to see some percentage of that. In my mind also, I think botnets are going to be a growing concern because they represent what amounts to a Swiss Army knife for attackers. You can really use them to mount all sorts of attacks or really use them to get all sorts of interesting, sensitive information from people's machines.
Where are these threats going to go? What's going to happen in the next several years?
I think that we're going to see a number of interesting trends in the next few years. I mean, I think traditional malware, if you will, has been really focused on trying to steal, you know, real dollars and cents from, you know, credit card transactions, that sort of thing. What I wouldn't be surprised to see is that we start to see a growing interest in malware that targets, let's say, secondary financial markets that may be derived from the Internet. So, for example, various types of online games do have currencies associated with them. You can actually buy and sell goods in those games and acquire assets that are virtual. Now, what's happening is a lot of those virtual assets have taken on real-world value through secondary markets. People who are very interested in the game tend to want to pay real money for those assets. And so I think we're going to start to see theft of virtual assets as a way that crime will proliferate. And the reason that that's interesting is that these virtual assets basically form what amounts to an unregulated currency system. And when it's unregulated, it's very easy for someone to come in and potentially do damage to it without really being noticed because the currency system hasn't been set up for that. You know, whereas traditional currency systems have been set up for types of monitoring and so on and so forth. So I expect that that's going to be one interesting area where we'll see the move in crimeware. The other area which I think we're starting to see a bit more of now and which we had talked about in the book has been in the realm of politically motivated crimeware. And here we're talking about people who may not be motivated so much by money, but maybe have some political aspirations behind their activities. So I suspect that we'll see, you know, quite a bit of that moving forward as technology tends to develop. And then finally, I expect that we'll see, just in general, crimeware trying to affect new types of applications and new platforms, whether it be mobile phones or PDAs or converged devices, for that matter. I think there the biggest challenge will be that up until now there hasn't been one dominant standard in that industry. And as a result, I think the attackers tend to shy away from that because what they want to do is they want to be able to come up with essentially a one-size-fits-all attack. So they would like to be able to attack a resource and have that attack be successful in netting them a profit. If there are many different standards out there, it's very difficult to have a single attack that's going to, let's say, work across all those standards. So I suspect that's really been the reason why we haven't seen as much activity in the mobile or PDA space as in the personal computer space. But I think that as certain standards become more popular, we may see a change in that.
What about virtual terrorism? Everyone in the country depends so much on the Internet. A couple of weeks ago, there was a fairly large outage in Chicago, and it affected about half of the websites that I use on a regular basis. And for a couple of hours, I was essentially lost. What happens if someone manages some sort of an attack that takes down large pieces of the backbone?
That'll be a very scary prospect indeed. I know that we had seen a big example of that in Estonia. And Estonia, you know, believe it or not, is actually a very wired country. I think people do most of their banking online in Estonia. They tend to be very, very dependent on the internet. And there was a question about an attack that actually occurred on Estonia's infrastructure. It was pretty clearly planned and coordinated to try to take down their infrastructure and prevent people from being able to access the types of services that they were used to accessing. Now, I think that particular attack, there was a belief that it was based out of Russia. You know, there are people who have dispelled that or people who have confirmed that. But I think the upshot is the same, is that we are definitely seeing, bin this into politically motivated crime work. But here, the idea is that we are seeing attacks on infrastructures, and it's certainly a lot more difficult to mount. But with technology today and with the advance in the way that malicious software has been written over the last few years, it's becoming more and more feasible to be able to mount such attacks.
One of the incidents that you mentioned in Crimeware, Understanding New Attacks and Defenses, was one where some USB devices were simply lost outside of a big office building. And, of course, people found them, picked them up, took them in, plugged them into their machines.
So, yeah, I think that's a really interesting example of an attack, because it relied on social engineering as opposed to technical engineering. The idea was that the attackers basically convinced people to compromise their own systems by essentially just inserting carte blanche, an infected device, into their system and letting it to compromise them. Now, I think that whole move towards social engineering is a very interesting one, because I believe that most of the attacks today try to take advantage of these social vulnerabilities. It's not just about finding a hole in the operating system or an application. It's really about, can I just send this user an email and hope that they'll click on the link and infect themselves? And I think attackers are finding that method is so successful that there's no reason to really worry that much about doing something that's more technically sophisticated. You know, at the same time, we definitely still see attacks that are very technically sophisticated, and certainly do see attacks that exploit technical vulnerabilities in systems. But I would say that those are, in some sense, the exception rather than the rule.
The weak link in social engineering and in a lot of other instances seems to be the human.
Right.
And the solution is obviously going to be education, but there are a lot of people, maybe the majority of people who use computers, don't really understand what's going on, don't want to understand what's going on. How do you get past that hurdle?
That's an excellent question. I think we actually spent quite a bit of time in the book talking about user education as one particular approach for dealing with this problem. So I think ultimately, you know, I think nobody would dispute that the ability to raise awareness in users and individuals who use machines would be a great thing in terms of being able to mitigate a lot of these threats. At the same time, I think we found over the years that doing so is very challenging, and even trying to do user education campaigns, it doesn't always work as effectively as we'd like or as we'd hope. And I think the reason for that is that ultimately this is not very simple technology. Underneath, there's a lot of complexity in the way systems work, and for someone to kind of walk in without, let's say, a computer science degree to try to figure out whether they're being safe online, I think it's quite a lot to expect of end users. So I think that, you know, you're 100% right. I think the end users represent the weak link. At the same time, I feel that we should never blame the end user, because ultimately we need to be able to solve these problems in a way that allow them to be able to do their business. And we can't expect people to have to, you know, understand technical details if they are, you know, to use our systems. And so my personal feeling is that a lot of it has to be addressed through a combination of both technology and policy. So on the technical side, we have to do a better job of trying to detect some of these threats proactively and in a way that is still seamless and is essentially unbeknownst or agnostic of the user, so that everything that the user does is basically, you know, transparent. At the same time, I think the technology can only go so far. On the other end, I think policy is going to be an interesting area. I think one thing that's made this whole crimeware proliferation happen is that we haven't necessarily built in the right incentives for making these types of activities difficult for, you know, users to stay away from. So, for example, you know, it might be the case today that if my machine gets infected, maybe my machine is only being used by an attacker to send out spam emails to some other machine. And so as an end user, I may not even notice or, you know, even care that my machine has been infected, since it's not directly affecting me. And these kind of imbalances, I think, make it very easy for an attacker to come in and do things that can stay under the radar for a very long time. I think the way to deal with a lot of those imbalances is through the development of appropriate policy that would basically set the playing field level and allow people to be, aligned in terms of their interests and goals moving forward.
What about Internet service providers? Certainly any home-based communications are going to go through there. Companies often connect directly to the backbone. But for individual home users, would getting the ISPs more involved help? If so, how do you incent them monetarily to get them to want to be involved?
Sure. I mean, we have actually worked a lot with a number of major ISPs at Symantec, and I know that they're definitely extremely interested in this problem. And they have an economic incentive to be interested in as well, because what ends up happening is a lot of these infected machines basically send out a lot of data. And essentially that data, that pipe is being paid for by the ISP. So they definitely have an economic incentive in terms of being able to prevent some of this activity. I think that they can do some things, but they can't do everything. And the reason for that is that ultimately, you know, what they're good at doing is monitoring what's going on in the network. A lot of the attacks these days, have taken one step further and encrypted, let's say, the payload that goes between the devices, and it makes it very difficult to monitor at a network level whether something bad is going on. And so I think that, it'll be, in some sense, we'll need a defense-in-depth type of play here, where the ISPs will play a certain role in terms of being able to protect against some of the more overt attacks that happen over the network, and we'll need client-side security software to be able to detect against attacks that are happening perhaps at the client itself and that are maybe encrypting their payloads to servers.
Seems to be like almost like a game of the technology moves forward, the defenses follow on, and then the bad guys go out and find some new way to attack.
Right. I definitely think there's a bit of a cat and mouse game, here between both the attackers and, companies like ourselves and ISPs and so on who have vested interest in making this activity go away. I think that the big challenge is that, technology is moving forward and attackers are certainly adapting to new technical trends. They're looking at what we're doing. They're trying to, modify their own activities as a result of that. But I think the one glimmering hope that often gets ignored in these discussions is that ultimately attackers are driven by profit. And when you have profit-driven attackers, you don't necessarily need to develop a silver bullet solution against them. You have to develop a solution that's good enough to limit their profitability or to hinder it or at least eliminate it. And that doesn't require maybe a perfect solution, but one that's good enough and at least sets the bar high enough that they're not willing to cross it anymore. And I think that's one of the saving graces, in today's world, given the attackers that we're dealing with. They're not just, out there not behaving irrationally. They're really trying to make a profit out of what they're doing. We found that if we set the bar just high enough that they're not making money, they tend to shift their attention elsewhere, or, certain types of activities do drop off and become less of a concern.